I'm Adrian Finnegan. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, the stakes are rising in the battle over Russian energy. Putin turns off the gas taps, and the EU proposes a ban on Moscow's oil imports by the end of the year. But what will the energy war cost? Also this week, Russia's ruble hits a two-year high, and its so-called fortress economy is believed to be holding up so far. But has Moscow really weathered the worst of sanctions? Netflix loses subscribers for the first time in a decade, and CNN Plus shuts down its platform just a month after launch. Have viewers had enough? And is the whole streaming industry at risk? Russia's President Vladimir Putin is making good on his threat to turn off the supply of natural gas to Europe. Supplies to Bulgaria and Poland have been halted after they refused to pay for gas in rubles. Other European countries may also be cut off within weeks if they too reject Russia's demand. The EU has dismissed the move as blackmail and is under pressure to cut the cord on Russian energy. The bloc has proposed a complete ban on all Russian oil imports by the end of the year.
We will make sure that we phase out Russian oil in an orderly fashion, so in a way that allows us and our partners to secure alternative supply routes and at the same time be very careful that we minimize the impact on the global market. With all these steps, we are depriving the Russian economy from its ability to diversify and to modernize. Putin wanted to wipe out Ukraine from the map, and he will clearly not succeed.
But natural gas has yet to be targeted with sanctions. Russia demanded that European companies pay for gas in euros to Gazprom Bank, which would then convert them into rubles in a secondary account. The EU rejected the ultimatum, saying that it violates sanctions, but several European firms had reportedly opened accounts at Gazprom Bank to meet Russia's payment demand. Poland and Bulgaria, which refuse to pay in rubles, say that they could cope without Russian gas. Sofia says that it's made alternative arrangements, while Warsaw insists that its energy supplies are secure. However, other countries could be hit hard if Russia cuts supplies. Germany's gas storage facilities are only 33.5% full. Italy's at 35%, and Hungary's at just 19.4%. But European governments are fast-tracking regulation that requires gas stores to be filled to 80% capacity before next winter. They've also set a year-end deadline to cut two-thirds of gas imports from Russia and plan to eliminate it completely by 2027. Now, more liquefied natural gas is being shipped from Qatar and the US. Piped natural gas imports from countries like Norway and Algeria will be increased, and the deployment of renewable energy will be accelerated, among other measures taken to decrease the dependence on Russian energy. Russia provides 40% of Europe's gas and 25% of its oil at a cost of some $850 million a day, and that accounts for at least 40% of Russia's revenues. Well, the price of gas surged by as much as 20% after Gazprom suspended deliveries, and the euro's value fell below $1.06 for the first time in 5 years. Europe's leaders say that they can't afford the consequences of an immediate boycott, and they're divided over the ban on Russian energy imports. Well, let's discuss this further with Michael Bradshaw, Professor of Global Energy at Warwick Business School. He joins us now from Coventry in the UK. Michael, European countries can't just stop using Russian gas overnight, and yet here they are faced with this dilemma of how to keep their supplies going while not breaching Russian sanctions. How are they going to do that?
It's very difficult. I mean, and I think it's a deliberate ploy by Vladimir Putin to make life difficult and drive division. So, you know, it's a very technical issue about how they should make their payments into Gazprom Bank. And the European Commission's determined that, you know, if you do what the Russians do, then you're in breach of sanctions. Actually, I don't think the European politicians want to see the gas stop flowing, because the gas situation is pretty difficult.
President Putin has made good on his threat, though, to cut off the gas. He's already done it to Bulgaria and to Poland. Who could be next?
Well, I think, you know, they selectively chose those countries. I mean, those countries had said they wouldn't follow the payment regime. Poland had already decided it wasn't going to renew its contract with Russia at the end of the year. and Bulgaria is not a major importer. I think it really what will determine this is what happens with the major importing countries, places such as Germany and Italy, who are not only highly dependent on Russian gas, but it's a large volume of gas and their industries reliant on that.
I was just going to ask you what all this is going to do to the price of gas as well. We as consumers, does it mean that wherever we are in the world are going to be paying more for natural gas?
Yes and no. I mean, I think this is affecting the sort of the short-term spot market, if you like. A lot of the natural gas that's traded as LNG into Asia is on long-term contracts and is actually indexed to the oil price. It's primarily in Europe where we've got a reliance on short-term spot markets, and the markets are... there's a very large fear factor in the price of gas. Interestingly, also, the gas price of gas, although it's much lower in the United States, has been going up because of demand for gas to export to Europe. So, it will affect every consumer in Europe and in the United States, and eventually in Asia, as they will also have to draw on the spot market. But in the Northern Hemisphere, of course, we're moving into summer and gas demand is always lower then.
What is President Putin's strategy here? He's not going to shoot himself in the foot by cutting off gas supplies to major customers. He must have a plan here.
Well, talk about shooting himself in the foot. I mean, I think this whole question of the war in Ukraine, I can't see that are there any winners in it. I don't see what Putin is standing to gain from destroying the position of Russia as a reliable supplier of fossil fuels to Europe. So if he has a plan, it's probably already backfired.
Can the Russian economy withstand the loss of so much energy revenue?
Well, the thing at the moment, of course, is that when you talk about revenue, the prices are so high that if the volumes fall, the revenue still remains quite high. And in fact, in the last 6 months, natural gas imports have earned huge amounts of money. And in the past, they used to be very much second place to oil. Again, the oil price is also high, but Russia is trading its oil at a very significant discount at the moment. But it is finding buyers. So I think over the longer term, this will start to have a major impact on the Russian economy. It will take time for Russia, for Europe to find alternative sources of supply, and it will be costly and difficult for Russia to find alternative markets for its oil. So I would think, over the longer term period, this will really start to impact on the Russian economy.
You say that Russia is finding buyers. Where are those buyers? China? They're in Asia. Are they going to be able to fill the gap that Europe is leaving?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think that, yes, there's been talk of Chinese buyers. I think they're not the national oil companies. I think they're the smaller private refineries. India has been taking some cargoes, but not the size, the volumes that Russia has been exports to Europe. Europe's by far its most important market. It's also having to send that oil further on ships, and it's struggling to find ships and get insurance for shipping. So all of those things are going to make it much more difficult to maintain exports and earnings at the level they have been in the recent past. It's not an easy matter suddenly to sort of readjust markets this way.
Are there enough energy alternatives for Europe to plug the gaps then, if it's not reliant upon or not relying as much upon Russian gas and oil?
Again, it's a question of time. And if you look at the various plans which have come out from the International Energy Agency and from the European Union itself, I mean, in the short term, It's going to be very challenging. They're talking about importing more LNG, which is already happening from the United States. But they're also looking at the demand side of the equation. What can we do to reduce the amount of gas, for example, that we consume? And, of course, these very high prices of oil, for example, they also drive demand destruction. People drive less. They're much more cautious about their energy usage. So a combination of demand side factors, perhaps, and some reorientation of supply, but there is still going to be a gap. And if gas deliveries do get disrupted in the coming next winter, then we'll be seeing potentially power cuts and industry having to shut down.
We'll come back to that in just a moment, because that's an important point. But in the meantime, you mentioned about people looking to alternative supplies. Will this crisis hasten, do you think, the shift, accelerate the transition to renewable energy supplies?
Well, very much so. That's the intent in Europe with their various plans, and it's also intent in the UK with our energy strategy, that this is going to accelerate the transition away. So it's not just about moving away from Russian oil and gas, it's accelerating the move away from oil and gas from anywhere by promoting the low-carbon transition.
So we talked a few moments ago about President Putin perhaps shooting himself in the foot here with having an unrealistic strategy. If we're going to be facing power cuts in Europe as early as next winter. Could it be argued that perhaps European leaders are doing the same? They're going to hurt themselves economically by moving away from Russian gas and oil.
Yes, absolutely. And I think you'll see that some European leaders in the last day or so have talked about sanctions as being a double-edged sword. And you hear a similar sort of rhetoric from Putin in the terms of Europe's hurting itself. But, I mean, that's the price that we have to pay if we're going to take actions that really do hurt Russia. But, yes, it is going to have an impact. There's no doubt about that.
Are there any winners in this situation?
It's hard to find them. Obviously, at the moment, international oil companies are delivering record profits. I'm assuming that other oil exporting states are doing well. But the knock-on effect of these very high prices may be very negative in terms of the global economy. And that may, again, drive demand destruction and less income. So I think just coming out of the pandemic and having this level of disruption in the global economy is not good for anyone. And I can't see any real winners from this.
Professor, it's been really good to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Thank you very much. Bye.
So why does the Russian president want payments in rubles? Well, one answer could be to shore up the currency, which plunged to historic lows after Vladimir Putin sent his troops into Ukraine, unleashing unprecedented Western sanctions that have battered the Russian economy. But now, thanks in part to higher commodities prices, banks have returned to a liquidity surplus and the ruble has rallied, hitting a two-year high against the euro and the dollar. And the central bank has reversed its policy of steep increases to borrowing costs. Interest rates have been cut by a further 3% in an attempt to boost the economy. The main lending rate, which was raised in the immediate aftermath of the invasion, is now at 14%. Russia has imposed capital controls to prevent Russians moving their money out of the country and requires the country's exporters to convert most of their foreign currency revenues into rubles. And the ruble has gained more ground after the country said that it managed to pay back creditors with dollars as Russia tries to avoid defaulting on its debts. The Russian finance ministry said that it made a $565 million eurobond payment that was due this year, as well as settling an $84 million eurobond that was set to mature in 2 years. Russia has lost access to much of its foreign currency reserves due to sanctions and wants to pay lenders in rubles, but credit ratings agencies have rejected that suggestion. But Russia is expected to suffer a deep recession. The central bank warned that the economy may face 2 straight years of contraction, estimated at up to 10% this year. It also expects inflation to increase by around 20% over the coming months. And the interruptions to supply chains caused by the sanctions are crippling Russia's production capacities. There was a 72% drop in passenger car production in the country, for example, in March. Well, joining us now from London is Tatiana Orlova, lead emerging market economist at Oxford Economics. Tatiana, good to have you with us. And the first question has to be, why is President Putin insisting right now that energy payments have to be made in rubles?
Hello, and thank you for inviting me today. I think, first of all, this is a political statement, and it's understandable in the current geopolitical context. The purpose of this announcement was basically it should be viewed as a sanction in response to the West imposing biting sanctions on Russia, and it has been targeted at so-called unfriendly countries which have imposed such sanctions. But actually, if we look at the mechanism itself, which Russia has proposed, it doesn't actually demand European buyers to pay in rubles. It demands them to pay into accounts in Gazprom Bank, which and payments can be made in the regional currency of the contract, mostly euros. And the trick here is that this money is going to be then converted into rubles in Russia. So strictly speaking, the decree which Putin signed does not demand payment in rubles.
Okay, the ruble itself is on slightly firmer ground right now. It's risen against the dollar and the euro a touch. Has Russia avoided the worst of what the sanctions were designed to do? I mean, is it going to avoid an economic collapse?
Well, yes, we can actually say that the first phase of this crisis has now finished, and actually the Russian authorities have managed to avoid a meltdown in the banking sector, for example, or a complete meltdown in the FX market. And this was done by a combination of capital controls and a huge rate hike, which the central bank implemented in the days after the invasion. So the rate hike was 1,050 basis points, which is very large. And the capital controls are preventing investors from moving their funds out of Russia, which is reducing the pressure on the ruble. So if we look at where the ruble is trading now, it's actually trading at stronger levels versus US dollar than it was in the days preceding the beginning of this conflict.
All right, so the economy is weathering the storm for the moment, but for how long can it continue to do so?
Well, there are some long-term processes which now have been launched in the economy. Deep changes will be happening to the structure of the economy as Russia is going to pivot away from Europe towards Asia. So trade ties are going to be cut. They're already being cut with Western buyers of Russian exports, self-sanctioning and curtailing the imports of Russian commodities mostly. Russia is no longer able to import a lot of goods from the countries which have imposed sanctions against it. So these processes have already been launched. It's just the matter of months and perhaps years before we can see the full impact of these measures.
And the country is, I mean, there's no doubt the country is headed for quite a deep recession, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Our current forecast sees a recession of contraction in the output of about 10% this year and further 3% next year.
And what impact is all of that going to have on the cost of living for ordinary Russians?
The cost of living has already increased considerably. Prices increased in March by 7.6% versus their level in February, so it was quite a sharp shock. But after that, actually, the price growth slowed down because, as I have said, the ruble exchange rate stabilized and returned to its previous level. So there is no further pressure on prices from the currency side.
And we mentioned a few moments ago that the country has managed to pay off some of its debt. What are the long-term prospects on that? Can Russia afford to keep servicing its debt? Is there a danger somewhere down the line if this economic pressure continues for maybe 1-2 years or longer of Russia defaulting on its debt?
Russia has very low level of government debt. So I think that even despite the current measures currently discussed by the European Union regarding the phasing out Russian oil and gas, I think still Russia still should be able to pay its debt. If the oil price at some point in the future collapses, as it has happened in the past, then the situation will probably change. But at the moment, the main risk of Russian default is stemming from its ability to actually perform these payments. It's effectively up to U.S. authorities whether to allow U.S. banks to process further debt payments by the Russian government. So this is where the main risk is.
Tatiana, it's been great to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me again.
Now, it's known for global hits like Squid Game, Money Heist and The Crown. Netflix has been top of the league in streaming services for a long time now. But pandemic restrictions that kept people glued to their screens are receding. Competition is getting tougher and Netflix is losing subscribers for the first time in a decade. The platform lost 200,000 subscribers in the first 3 months of the year and expects to lose 2 million more in the second quarter. The announcement sent the company's stock down more than 35% last week, wiping at least $54 billion off its market value. Netflix generated revenue of almost $8 billion in the first 3 months of the year, but that marked a slowdown from previous quarters, while profits fell by more than 6%. And it's not only Netflix that has faced a slump. Shares in Disney, Roku, Paramount and Warner Brothers, Discovery have also slipped, while CNN is shutting down its streaming service, CNN Plus, just a month after it was launched. On the flip side, HBO at HBO Max had almost 78 million subscribers at the end of the first quarter of 2022. That's around a 13 million year-on-year increase. Joining us from London, Tim Mulligan. He's a senior analyst and research director at Midea Research. Tim, good to have you with us. Where's it all gone wrong for Netflix?
That's a big question. Simply put, Netflix have reached a certain level of growth and development where the easy wins for continuing that rapid growth trajectory over the previous decade are no longer there. And principally that comes from two key areas. One is competition in their core markets, predominantly the domestic market, the US, which still accounts for over a third of their subscribers. But then it's where the growth has been coming over the last few years, ever since they made the pivot back in 2017 to focus on international subscribers. That growth is leveling off because they're moving into markets that don't actually have the discretionary income to be able to afford monthly subscriptions. So the competition are now moving into ad-supported propositions, and this is something that Netflix has noticeably pushed back against having as part of their offering. Their core USP is an ad-free on-demand viewing experience. The final observation I'd make about why Netflix is starting to struggle with growth and retention is a combination of their portfolio of content. So they noticeably don't have news and noticeably don't have sports in their lineup. Now, this is essential to be able to offer a streaming TV alternative to traditional pay TV, which is effectively what we're talking about here. Subscription video services are streaming pay TV. So they lack that. Some of the other notable competitors moving into the market over the last 3 years have that. And that's something they lack, so it's something that they may want to reconsider. The other final piece is to add for why Netflix is currently in this challenging position is we're entering what Midea calls the attention recession. Now, attention recession is when the combination of the long-term strategic limits of being able to engage because of organic constraints to sleep are also matched by the return of in real life entertainment alternatives. Okay. You know, people are able to get out of their homes and able to socialize again, and able to do all the traditional entertainment formats that weren't available during the lockdown. Yeah. Remember that there are still parts of the world that are coming out of that lockdown period. So inevitably, that combines with this long-term secular peak in attention engagement to create an attention recession.
Have we passed peak streaming, do you think? Do you think the market is just too saturated?
Yes and no. It's a qualified yes and no, because what we're experiencing here is a transition from traditional TV consumption to streaming TV consumption. We're moving into the streaming TV era. So that still means that there are some legacy behaviours around traditional linear TV consumption that will migrate over to streaming. But what is undoubtable is we've also got these constraints and the amount of time that can be spent with home entertainment, the return of in real life entertainment, the looming attention recession means that growth is no longer going to be easily found. And the other aspect of this is the subscription model of streaming services today, the predominantly subscription model, is now being augmented and will inevitably be surpassed by ad-supported streaming. In the same way, traditional TV has been divided between pay TV and through broadcast TV. Broadcast TV has traditionally been the majority of the market. The majority of consumers are willing to tolerate adverts to engage with content. It's the minority who are willing to pay for an ad-free experience. So that will inevitably translate into streaming, especially as this becomes a global phenomenon and moves beyond developed markets, which are now increasingly saturated with subscription services.
Fascinating. Tim, it's been really good to talk to you. Many thanks indeed for being with us on Counting the Cost.
You're welcome. Thank you for your time.
And that's our show for this week. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with us about anything that you've seen, you can tweet me. I'm at A Finnegan on Twitter. Please use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or you can drop us a line. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our email address. As always, there's plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That takes you straight to our page, and there you'll find individual reports, links, even entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Adrian Finnegan from the whole team here in Doha. Thanks for being with us. The news is next on Al Jazeera.